welcome to tonight's program. It's about 7 past the hour. The phone number here is 877-996-2556, as we used to say years ago, and it's toll-free. So if you want to call in early, you can do so. I used a lot of different sources to come up with material for this program, as you are well aware, I'm sure. Unlike right-wingers, we don't use just the RNC and the Rupert Murdoch Terror Broadcast Organization. We actually use many, many sources, domestic, global. One of them, up to this point, has been Politico, politico.com. But I think I'll stay away from politico.com now. Usually they have the managing editor or some senior editor, somebody, on Morning Joe every morning on MSNBC. I think I'm going to stay away from Politico for the time being. I had no idea they could be this hypocritical, unless this is a joke. And I don't think it is. They are streaming live their they're having awards dinner tonight honoring what they consider to be policymakers of the year in a variety of categories and fields. And as Steve Bannon at Washington Monthly writes, that wouldn't be especially interesting were it not for the news organization's choice for healthcare policymaker of the year. Yeah. Healthcare policymaker of the year. Now, before I tell you who it is, let me mention that this hour is being sponsored by Hexistore, hexistore.com. Again, thanks, guys, at Hexistore. Andrew at hexistore.com, sponsoring this hour. Provider of online backup service, where we all want to be like Mike. Oh, really? And then Andrew adds, thanks to all the listeners. Go to their website. They are sponsoring this program. They are another one of these small businesses that, like Heel and Hollers and what is it? Fish, Evolve Fish, and several small businesses. Hexistore, Hexistore.com. No, we don't have gold companies sponsoring it. Anyway, Andrew is the sponsor of the first hour. Thanks, Andrew. So, Politico. Here's their press release. When House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan released his budget plan in April, the Wisconsin Republican instantly changed the conversation about health care in America. It wasn't always a polite conversation, and it gave way to new Democratic charges that Republicans want to, quote, end Medicare, end quote. But Ryan got everybody talking about ways to get health care entitlements under control. And he gave Republicans the most detailed illustration to date of how market forces could be used to do just that. He has influenced how Republican presidential candidates such as Mitt Romney talk about health care, as they use variations of his, Ryan's, Medicare plan in their campaigns. And if Republicans gain power after the 2012 elections, Ryan's blueprint is sure to be the starting point for their future health care policies. End quote. Politico. Now, how many of those two paragraphs I just read, how much garbage and crap is in there? First of all, the second sentence, and it gave way to new Democratic charges that Republicans want to, quote, end Medicare, end quote. Democrats do want to do that. But Politico puts quotes around it as if it were a facetious statement or an untrue statement. Of course Republicans want to end Medicare. They want to destroy it. And then Politico says, Ryan got everyone talking about how to get health care entitlements under control. Under control? He gave Republicans the most detailed illustration to date of how market forces could be used to do that. Market forces on Medicare? You're kidding. Politico goes on to say, Ryan has influenced how Republican presidential candidates such as Mitt Romney talk about health care. What? Mitt Romney talks about health care as if it were a friend of his with leprosy. Mitt Romney introduced health care into the state of Massachusetts and now runs from it like a goddamn coward that he is. What are you talking about, Politico? What are you talking about? One more mainstream media victim. I guess Politico figures this will get them major advertisers that they apparently, I don't know, desperately need. So they decide to stab people in the back with lies about Paul Ryan. And the last line, if Republicans gain power after the 2012 elections, Ryan's blueprint. Blueprint? Destruction of Medicare? That's a blueprint now. His blueprint is sure to be the starting point for their future health care policies. Okay, you destroy Medicare, you end Medicaid, and then you turn it all over to the private sector, over to the predatory capitalists. This is what Politico, they're going to award this guy tonight, if they haven't already. And as Steve Bannon writes, giving an award to someone for getting, quote, everyone talking, end quote, seems like an unusual standard. For tributes, you honor somebody because you got people talking? What were they saying in that conversation? Or the main thing, they were saying that Paul Ryan is a loony son of a bitch. That's what they were saying. And when a policymaker gets everyone talking about how ridiculous his proposal is, you don't generally reward him with some kind of year-end honor, do you? I guess you do if you're Politico.com. Boy, you boys have really, and girls, have really dropped back 10 yards and punted now. I cannot believe this. Paul Ryan, huh? See, this is what happens. This is what happens with corporate media. Eventually, every goddamn one of them sells out. Every single one of them. Just like Bain Capital LLC closing down liberal talk across the country. Politico giving an award to in the policymaker of the year category to Paul Ryan? Maybe Politico, as Steve points out, maybe Politico has forgotten some of the more important realizations from the debate that Paul Ryan got going. First, Ryan's health care agenda repealed everything about the Affordable Health Care Act, repealed the entire thing, in the process taking coverage away from millions of Americans and replacing it with nothing. It's not just Medicare. It's everything. Destroy everything. What's more, by scrapping the Affordable Care Act altogether, Ryan would add billions to the deficit. And his plan said, no, it's not going to do that. It's going to do just the opposite. And he offered no evidence whatsoever. It was a goddamn lie. It was just typical Republican garbage. And Politico.com is rewarding him for being a liar. Second, Ryan's plan claimed to control health care costs. A closer look reveals that Ryan's claims were wrong. Indeed, Ryan pushed to shift Medicare cost burdens from the government to families. And third, accusations that the Ryan plan would end Medicare were accurate. Ryan intended to scrap the existing program, replacing it with a privatized voucher scheme. Remember that? And the vouchers wouldn't cover escalating costs. To know all this, and to give this guy an award, Healthcare Policymaker of the Year, is madness. Politico, you've lost your mind, or you've completely sold out. To hell with you.
mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people. It's Mike Malloy.
It is indeed. 21 past the hour. Well, while it's still warm, just out of the oven, from Prairie 2, if it can happen, then it will happen, I think is what the subject line says here. It's a little garbled there, Bruce. President Obama journeyed to Osawatomie, Kansas on Air Force One today to essentially repeat a speech made by another president who traveled there by steam train. Actually, by 1910, Teddy Roosevelt had been voted out of office for being a socialist. Well, many things have changed since then. The first powered flight happened during Roosevelt's term, and it covered less ground than the footprint of a presidential plane now. We still find ourselves in many ways worse off than the Gilded Age that Roosevelt railed against in his speech. Teddy Roosevelt demanded the end of child labor, higher wages for men, and even a minimum wage for women. He wanted laws to protect workers from injury and sickness. After a century, we're on the verge of this all being reversed by a President Newt, who now leads Romney 2-1 in Iowa. Teddy Roosevelt wanted a living wage for every man, something the majority of Americans no longer have, and soon this will be a luxury exclusively for the 1%. You could say Obama is simply trying to define himself as a progressive to win the votes of the middle class, and he mentioned them 25 times in his speech today. Contrast this with the advice of right-wing propagandist Frank Luntz to Republicans to never mention the middle class. Call them hardworking Americans instead. Never say capitalism. Never talk about taxing the rich. Wall Street's hundreds of billions in bonuses are now pay for performance. Calling it pirate booty would be more accurate. So if you want to make the argument that Obama is just another shill for Wall Street, then why would he say such dangerous things out loud from the bully pulpit that Teddy Roosevelt had a penchant for breaking up monopolies. No U.S. president has spoken openly of such a thing in decades. It's true that Obama didn't actually call for this, but he did lay out part of the Dodd-Frank Act that will break up any large bank or corporation that threatens the financial stability of the nation instead of bailing them out. Obama talked about billionaires who only pay 1% income tax, and this is something you never hear on the corporate news. About CEOs that make 110 times the pay of workers. Remember, Frank Luntz calls this pay for performance. That wasn't the tone of Obama's speech, but from the president, tone matters. To be sure, a speech is just words, but when the president of the United States says things like this, it shapes the public discourse and can inspire voters to look for candidates that might make this happen. Republicans brought us the Cold War this way, and hot wars around the world as well. They brought us trickle-down economics, free trade, and the endless war on terror this way. This president is talking the talk of the 99%. If he's doing it only to get reelected, so what? It only matters that the 99%, the real 99%, not just a handful of protesters at the Occupy sites, start talking this way. Then it can happen. Then it will happen. Bruce at Prairie 2. You can see the text, the full text of Obama's speech today if you go to Bruce's website, prairienumeral2.com. All right, so the subject line is, then it can happen, then it will happen. Okay, well, I guess it does make sense. At the very end of your email, Bruce. the Supreme Court has ruled that essentially corporations are human. They have the same rights and entitlements and privileges as humans, but apparently none of the responsibilities. If you or I committed the kind of fraud and murder that Massey Energy and Halliburton are now being charged with, you or I would, in a number of states in this dissolving union, we would be executed. In the rest of the states, we would probably get life with no parole. But Massey Energy and Halliburton, Massey Energy, a fine in the millions of dollars. Halliburton, so far nothing. Both of these corporations are responsible for death. 29, we're only talking about one instance here with Massey Energy, much more than this, but 29 deaths in West Virginia back in, when was it? 2010, a year ago. And Halliburton, also about a year and a half ago, responsible for the deaths of 13, was it 13 people who died on the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig? No, 11 people died. And God only knows how much damage to the ecosystem in the Gulf of Mexico. But both of these, I want to focus a little bit on these when we come back from the break. If corporations are, in fact, entitled to the same rights, why not the same responsibilities? I say that executives of Halliburton and Massey should be tried in the states where these crimes occurred. And I believe off the I think Louisiana still has the death penalty. Maybe somebody will take a look at that for me. And I think West Virginia still has the death penalty. If that's the case, then the executives of Massey and Halliburton should be tried, and if they're found guilty, executed. This hour is being sponsored by Andrew at HexIsStore.com. H-E-X-I-S-T-O-R. Hex is store. H-E-X-I-S-T-O-R. HexIsStore.com. They provide online backup service. And that's the place where, according to Andrew, we all want to be like Mike. Thanks to all the listeners. Thank you, Andrew, for the sponsorship. HexIsStore. H-E-X-I. S-T-O-R, HexIsStore.com. Check them out. So BP says Halliburton destroyed evidence regarding the Gulf oil spill. Well, of course. This is a Cheney company. Of course. This is a capitalist organization. This is an energy company. This is a corporation. Of course they destroyed evidence. Why wouldn't they? Eh? BP is accusing Halliburton of destroying evidence that Halliburton did inadequate cement work on the Gulf of Mexico oil well that blew out last year and has asked a federal judge to punish Halliburton. Citing recent depositions in Halliburton's own documents, BP said Halliburton intentionally destroyed the results of slurry testing for the well, in part to, quote, eliminate any risk that this evidence would be used against it at trial, end quote. The oil company BP also said that Halliburton appeared to have lost computer evidence. Yeah, they lost it. Oh, my goodness, we just lost it. We don't know what we did with it. They lost computer evidence showing how the cement performed, with Halliburton maintaining that the information is simply, quote, gone, end quote. That's what Halliburton said. No, we didn't lose it. It's gone. What? It's gone. Produced it. It's gone. It's gone. BP has asked U.S. District Judge Carl Barbier in New Orleans, who oversees spill litigation, to sanction Halliburton by ruling that Halliburton's slurry design was, quote, unstable, close quote, a finding of fact that could be used at trial. And BP also asks Barbier, or Barbier, how do you however you pronounce it, the U.S. District Judge down there, to direct that forensic experts be hired to find the missing computer data. Ooh. BP said in the filing, quote, these remedies are amply warranted in law and by principles of fair play. and they are essential to ensure the court's trial is not tainted by Halliburton's misconduct. Spokeswoman Beverly Stafford for Halliburton said that we're reviewing BP's filing. She said, we believe that the conclusion that BP is asking the court to draw is without merit, and we look forward to contesting their motion in court. Next. Eleven people died on August 20, 2010. Oh, and Halliburton has accused BP of fraud and defamation. Defamation of character. Halliburton. Oh, Jesus Christ. This is the company that sold equipment to our soldiers in Iraq that caused our soldiers in Iraq to be electrocuted to death. This is the company that put tainted, poisoned water into cans and sold it. Well, Kellogg Brown and Root, but, you know, same operation. Son of a bitch. So, pointing that out resulted in Halliburton filing a defamation of character. Since when does a corporation have character? Well, come on, Mike. They're people now. Sort of. Sort of people. BP has also sued Transocean Limited, which owned the rig, Cameron International Corporation, which made a blowout preventer. So Halliburton destroyed evidence, according to BP. Halliburton says the evidence, no, we didn't destroy it, just gone. That's something a five-year-old would say. Where's your spinach? It was just on your plate. It's gone. Did you eat it? It's gone. And now, wait a minute. A spinach on your plate, now it's not there. Did you eat it?
It's gone.
How old are you, Billy?
I'm five.
Where's the spinach?
It's gone.
It's gone. It's gone. Billy, would you like, when you grow up, to go to work for Halliburton? Jesus, God. Oh, and Alpha Natural Resources has agreed to pay $209 million in restitution and civil and criminal penalties for the role of its subsidiary, Massey Energy, in the mine explosion that killed 29 men in West Virginia. The amount includes $46.5 million allocated to the families of the victims and those who were injured in the blast, and includes terms that protect Alpha from criminal prosecution. Of course. Oh, it doesn't protect individual Massey executives, but it protects Alpha Natural Resources. See, Alpha pays the fine, but when it comes to being put on trial for murder and possibly executed, oh, no, 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 not us. Oh, no, 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 no. Go see Billy, the one that makes the spinach disappear, but not us. No, no, no. This announcement comes on the same day that the Mine Safety and Health Administration imposed a $10.8 million fine, the largest in its history, on the company. $10.8 million on Massey, on Alpha Natural Resources? What is that? That's a rounding error. $10.8 million? Sure, we'll pay it. All right. The federal agency, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, said Massey and its subsidiary, which was operating the Upper Big Branch mine at the time of the blast, had been cited a total of 369 times for safety and health violations. Can you believe this? God damn it, think about this. I'll tell you what, do, truth seeker. Go into your local Macy's. Steal a pair of socks. Do it 369 times. Ha 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 ha. On the fourth time, your ass goes to prison forever. But Massey Energy, 369 mine violations, including improperly trained miners, allowing hazardous levels of loose coal and coal dust to accumulate, and failing to comply with ventilation plans. Oh, who cares? They're just dumbass hillbilly miners, right? What are their miserable lives worth? So the mine explodes. So what? Pay off their heirs. Well, that's what we would call them. I get, what do they call them up there in the mountain? Next of kin. Pay off their next of kin and move on. The Mine Safety Agency said that the investigation found that the operator promoted and enforced a workplace culture that valued production over safety, including practices calculated to allow it to conduct mining operations in violation of the law. Yeah. In a statement today, Kevin Crutchfield, Alpha's chief executive, Alpha Natural Resources, said that, quote, the agreements we've reached represent the best path forward for everyone, end quote. Let us move forward. As far as the families of the 29 men murdered by Massey Energy and Alpha Natural Resources, the 29 men murdered, pay off their next of kin and shut them up. They don't matter. They're West Virginia hillbillies. They're stump jumpers. They don't matter. When we feel like it, we'll blow off the tops of more of their mountains. When we feel like it, we'll pollute the streams and rivers. When we feel like it, we'll make damn good and sure that nobody in that disgusting area of the country that happens to be where our coal is buried has any decent drinking water or air to breathe. Pay them off. Let's move on. Let's move on. The agreements we've reached represent the best path forward for everyone. Let's go. Excelsior! Onward! In the past, up until this ruling, Massey had dismissed the charges that its actions led directly to the disaster. Oh, no, not us. We don't have anything to do with it. They have anything to do with it. It's those goddamn hillbillies. They did it. The agreement also requires that the parent corporation, Alpha, put in place a plan that guarantees it has enough safety equipment, ventilation, and methods of clearing potentially explosive rock dust out of its underground mines within 90 days. And when all these agreements are reached, then miraculously, the 29 dead men will arise and be whole again and go back to their families.
It's Mike Malloy.
We were together. We were on the ball. 10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Hexastore.com. Hex. I-S-T-O-R. Hexastore.com. Provider of online backup service. Thanks, Andrew Schmidt. Andrew says, Hexa Store, where we all want to be like Mike. Thanks to all the listeners. Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it. Visit their website. See what they've got. It might apply to you. specifically, Hexistor, H-E-X-I-S-T-O-R, hexistor.com. Be-doo. So, you think it's too harsh saying that the executives at Massey or Halliburton should be put on trial for murder, and if they're found guilty, let the penalty of the state in which they're found guilty apply? I don't think so. Not at all. Not at all. But this is just standard operating procedure. They accuse each other. Oh, and in the meantime, of course, BP has been granted further rights by the Obama administration to start more exploratory drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And the Obama administration has granted Shell permission to begin exploratory drilling in the Chukchi or whatever it is, the Arctic Ocean off the coast of Alaska, North Coast. And Mr. Obama has delayed a decision. You know what that means when they delay a decision until after an election. Come on. Come on. Oh, please. Jesus Christ. That's too. You made a great speech today, though, as Bruce Enberg pointed out. Bruce writes to me and he says, well, if he's just a chauffeur for Wall Street, why does he say the things he says? Bruce. Come on. Why did Big Brother say the things he said? Come on, come on, come on, come on. But he gave a great speech today, didn't he? Obama. He really did. And as far as the speech goes, I'm 100% there. I'm right there. You know? Extend the payroll tax cuts. Tax the rich. Tax these son of a bitches until their ears bleed. Yes, do it. Do it. Till their eyes bleed. Just bleed them out. Come on. Do it. They're not getting rich making stuff or providing jobs. Even though that's where the Republicans say, well, these are the job creators. Oh, are you out of your minds? Of course you are. But I digress. So BP is going to start the process all over again. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And didn't Mr. Obama, during his campaign, say that he was going to begin the process of ending our reliance on fossil fuels? But, you know, in a sense, and I'm going to talk about this later in the program, it really doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference. You know that eat, drink, and be merry, the second part of that, for tomorrow we shall die. Boy, is that right around the corner. Ooh, wait a minute. Dalen is in Los Angeles, listening on Sirius. Dalen, sorry, I lost control of myself there.
No problem.
All right.
Obama, I think that in the first term, you know, I have a background in political science and I work in marketing communications and public relations. So mm-hmm. I kind of do a lot of audience analysis for a living, and I've been watching this closely, and I think that a lot of presidents in their first term, they kind of take things slowly and carefully, but I'm noticing a little more aggression in a good way from Obama's side and the Obama administration, and I think that that's really what the American public wants to see. If we look at kind of from a historical analysis and think back to like Carter, Carter appeared too soft. And some claim that that's why he lost the election.
Well, I would disagree. I think he was painted as being soft. But I think Carter was trying. I think Carter fully understood that we lived, even back in the late 70s, in a really kind of sick economy, society that was spiraling down, down, down in just about every measurement, every metric that you can come up with. And Carter was trying to get people to man up or woman up and act like adults and face their problems. And I don't think he may have been perceived as weak, but that was because the right wing had begun the process of painting everyone except them as weak, and to whatever degree it worked. Now, as far as Obama's concerned, look, you know, I would vote for Obama again in a second if he would have done just a couple of things. First of all, did what he said he would do when he was a candidate. And I don't want to hear the argument from anybody. I'm not talking about you, Dalen, but the argument that, well, he couldn't because of pressures in the presidency. You don't know what the presidency is until you get there. Well, if that's really the case, then you walk in, you look around, you decide if you're going to be a president, and if the forces present are so overwhelming, then you get on the television on a given night and you resign the presidency. And you say, look, I had no idea. I really came in here to be a leader, and it's impossible. Now, that's a bit crazy on my part, I understand, but to me, a lot of these issues are black or white. There is no gray here, and that's just the way I feel. If Obama had lived up to his promises, A, B, if Obama had been aggressive and kicked these Republicans' asses when they went after him, I would have been voted for him a second time. I would have actively been working to get him reelected. Dalen, hold on a second, because I've done all the talking. And I want to hear what you got to say. So stick around till we get over this break, and we'll come back and pick it up right there. Right? You know what I'm talking about. If this president would have just fulfilled his campaign promises, I would be inclined to vote for him. But if he would have said to the Republicans, you lop-eared sons of bitches, are you out of your minds? And really kicked ass and took names? Ooh, man, I would be leading the charge. Dalen in Los Angeles, listening on Sirius. Now, you were talking about Obama starting to show some leadership quality.
Well, I think that you know, when he first ran, he ran on this concept of hope, and it was kind of this feel good type of thing, and now we're starting to see just in the tone of his communications, we're starting to see a little bit stronger tone. Now, action always, like you're saying, speaks louder than words. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly with you on, you know, if you can't handle the job, then don't do it. Mm-hmm. I think we really agree there on that point. But what I'm seeing is the tone actually starting to change. And from an audience analysis perspective, I think people and perhaps they should be looking at action. It's hard to get bills through Congress. I mean, I work in groups of people where there's a group of 10, and it's hard to get a decision out of 10 people in a group at the workplace, let alone an entire Congress. And I think that being more aggressive would definitely be in his favor to try to get some of these things, these initiatives passed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to be argumentative about Obama. I have pretty much stated my case about him. In a sense, I wish I didn't feel that way. I did not get a sense. I have to say this, though. I didn't get a sense during the campaign that it was feel good. I guess I should have. That it was feel good kind of rhetoric that was being coming out of the mouth of this 40-something man. I mean, this guy is very, very young. Not the youngest president, but close to it. And what I heard, and I think what a lot of progressives heard, because we so desperately wanted to, was somebody who was saying, elect me and things are going to change, immediately. There will be energy put in bringing this country back to a representative democracy, to a democratic republic. I will do away with these egregious episodes of misleadership that occurred over the past 8 years, whether it is with our treatment of detainees or our treatment of the predators on Wall Street or whatever it is. And as it turns out, you know, the first thing he does is hire the predators on Wall Street to come in and be his advisors. He's got the head of GE, who is a job destroyer, if ever there was one, acting as his advisor on how to produce jobs. Now, this is madness. This is, for me, for people like me out here, who really care about the country and the direction and the political system, this is insanity producing, because this goes way beyond doublespeak or newspeak or whatever it was that Orwell was talking about in the novel 1984. When you say you're going to do something punitive to the people who have brought about economic destruction to this country, and then hire the people who did it to work for you.
There was the case of America Online, just to kind of think of an analogous situation years ago, and this guy put up this website called AOL Sucks. And nobody was paying attention to it in the beginning, and then AOL started fighting it. And it turned into this big ruckus that I don't know if you remember, but it turned into this huge media deal. And AOL's like, what did we get ourselves into? If we would have just let this go, nobody would have paid attention to it. But in the end, what they did is they actually ended up hiring this guy because it silenced everything.
Right.
Now, I don't know if that was, you know, the tactic from like a public relations standpoint, but I'm kind of wondering if that's what the thinking was there in kind of a crisis type of communications management type of thing.
Well, I had the feeling during the campaign that resulted in his election that this was truly a transformational moment, and that Barack Obama was the transformational president, not this toad Newt Gingrich, who likes to identify himself as transformational, but oh my God, because we're on the cusp of everything I've been reading the past few days about climate change because of this conference that's going on in Durban, South Africa. Everything I've been reading from the scientific side, not the propaganda side, not the brain dead teabag side or the denier side, but just from the scientific side, everything I've been reading is just shocking, just absolutely, and to be honest, terrifying to me, that this planet is this close to going tilt. Like the old pinball machines. Once it went tilt, game over.
Absolutely.
And to see this president, in my opinion, having wasted the past almost 3 years, instead of standing up in a leadership stance and saying, okay, we're on the verge of committing planetary suicide. We have got to stop, and then taking the leadership to do that. But no. So, you know, when the smoke clears, when everything is weighed and evaluated here, Dalen, I like to listen to his speeches. I really do. I mean, I like the speech he gave today, but I know there's going to be no follow through. And how do I know that? Because I've seen it for almost 3 years now, over and over and over again. Right. He makes a powerful, hard hitting speech, and you can't help yourself. From if you're a Democrat, from wanting to start clapping and applauding and standing up and saying, yes, it's about time. And then as soon as he gets back to Washington, or as soon as the policy is supposed to be put in place, all of a sudden he's calling up the Republican Party leadership and saying to the effect, listen, I really don't mean it. I'll tell you what, I'll give away 90% of it if you'll just give me 10%. Okay.
Yep. Bush made no deal.
Right. Some moron like Bush made no deals. Absolutely.
So. You know, and you were mentioning this thing about accountability, which I really like. And just seeing the way that corporations act today and the leadership, they're all there at the shareholder meetings when the stocks are up and the company's doing great, you know, or whatever. And they're there when it comes to being accountable for that.
Right.
But nobody's there. The guy that's on the unsung hero on the front line, you know, the meter reader or the, you know, the guy, the garbage truck driver or the guys that are on the front line for these major companies. Nobody's taking accountability when the companies crash.
That's true.
Right? So you were talking about leadership a little bit ago, and just this element of accountability. I'll tell you, as a 99%er, when I go to work, I do a 9-to-5 every day. Usually it's, you know, more like an 8-to-8, but, I do a 9-to-5 every day, and I'm held accountable. I get coached on accountability. If something goes wrong, or the stuff hits the fan, guess who they go to?
Sure.
They point the finger at, you know, me.
Right.
But when it comes to the executive, nobody's being held accountable right now. And that's just a sham.
And we're so mad. To me, Dalen, worse than that is the executives who are crashing and burning these companies, have the so-called golden parachutes, and when they do bail out, they're given rewards for failure. And this is the very thing that these phony, hypocritical Republicans have always railed against, and it's always been phony, and it's always been hypocritical. Dalen, I got to leave it there. Thanks a lot. Enjoyed talking to you. Take care, okay?
It was great. Thank you so much.
All right, sir. Yeah, accountability. Yeah, Dalen's point is exactly right. Accountability by whom? Well, by the people who do the scut work, who do the sales, who build the product, who put in the long hours. The executives? No, I don't think so.
Flying Monkey Right, it's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. The number here is 877-996-2556. We had a temporary flub up with the phones. It's all fixed now, so if you were dialing in and got disconnected, try again. From John in Raleigh. Mike, the stuff won't end until you start getting calls from people who are borrowing a cell phone and who are living in a tent somewhere. When I had a good paycheck and heat and a car that ran, sure, I could speak philosophically about unfairness in the economy, but it wasn't real to me. Now it is. And I won't go into detail about my current situation. Americans are still too relaxed and don't feel that sting of a cold shower, can still get their teeth fixed, can buy food, and don't yet have a bank that gets a judge to issue a warrant or a foreclosure, or a sheriff's deputy knocking on the door to evict you, or the little white truck that rolls up to shut off the gas or electricity, or the tow truck that repos the car. No, Americans still don't get it. But they will. John in Raleigh. I take your point. Indeed. Mark is in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Hello, Mark.
What I'd like to see happen in this next election is an all-out effort to campaign against the Grover Norquist pledgers in Congress and the Senate that are up for election. Really, you know, we're never going to get a good or fair tax code here. We're never going to get the cap taken off for Social Security unless we get rid of these cockroaches in there.
That's very true.
You know, that's the key, Mike. I mean, we could do it all we want, but unless we get these guys out of there, we're never going to get any fairness in our, you know, in our tax code for the middle class. Grover Norquist basically had a death wish for the middle class. He wants to get rid of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. He just basically says he wants to destroy the middle class. So
yeah, how did somebody like this? And to me, the guy defines social pathology. He's a sociopath. How did he get to the point? This is a part I still don't understand, where he has any power at all. I mean, why isn't this guy out looking for a job, selling Amway or something? How did he get to the point where he can get these brain dead members of the Republican Congress to sign off on the stupid ass no tax pledge? Who is this guy? I mean, yeah, I can look him up on Wikipedia. I know who he is. But I mean, how did that happen? How did a piece of human waste like Grover Norquist, what does he have? Pictures of all these members of Congress having sex with small rodents? I mean, how does he do this?
Apparently, he gets enough people to fund him and his organization to threaten anybody that doesn't go along with the pledge that they'll primary them in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So it's basically, he is exactly what is wrong with Washington as long as he exists and he still has these pledge takers until we get rid of them. The thing is, Mike, what we have to do is make him toxic. So even if a Republican does get in, that whoever runs against them defeats these pledge takers every time, and then that's the way we'll get rid of them.
That's very true. You're listening on Green 960. Do you have access to a high-definition radio, Mark?
I'm going to get the equipment. I have a portable, but I'm going to get one in my car, and I'm going to follow Green 960 over to HD. I already have one radio, but I'm gonna gear up. You know, we're going to follow you, Mike. We're going to follow Green 960 over.
Well, you're not following Green 960. They're staying right where they are. They're going to be broadcasting on the same frequency, 960 AM. What they're doing is shuffling most of us liberals into the HD ghetto. But I'm glad that you're going to follow.
Oh yeah, Mike. And you know what? I don't know what's going on here in San Francisco because this is a progressive city. But there's something rotten going on here. But
it's not just San Francisco, and it's not just now. This has been going on for the 25 years that I've been in radio. This refusal on the part of corporate radio to provide anything other than, during their important day parts, anything other than a right-wing pro-corporate stance. They just simply won't do it. The stations that do have a few liberals on scattered here and there, especially ones like me who take no prisoners, we're usually relegated to, the late evening or sometime after midnight. So it's not new, and we're pretty used to it, but it's just an example of how corporate America, especially in the radio business, controls the debate. But I'm glad you're switching over when we get dumped into HD FM territory. Thanks, Mark. I got a boogie. I appreciate you checking in, as always. Take care, pal.
the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malone.
Five before the hour, Bruce Enberg writes regarding Grover Norquist and HD Radio. Grover is in himself simply nothing. The billionaires who hold the strings that make him dance have the power. He's like the mask the bank robber wears. Ew, that's almost poetic. And regarding HD radio, it is becoming standard on new radios. It works just like the digital, dot plus the number, channels that piggyback the main TV broadcast channels. It will take a few years for everybody to have one, but you could take the opportunity to stimulate the economy by encouraging everyone to buy one. Okay, it will mostly stimulate the economy in China, but you will provide a few law school grads with jobs at Best Buy. Boy, isn't that the truth. And in the meantime, just get a podcast. Now, when Bain Capital or Clear Channel tosses you lemons, you just squeeze it into lemonade and have a drink. You know what I'm saying? Cash is calling from Laredo, Texas, listening on Sirius. Hey, Cash.
How you doing, Mike?
All right.
Best called in actually a couple of years. Actually, I was calling in today to talk about this one event that happened here in our city. I don't know if you heard about it. Kind of made the Texas news. There was a woman who went into the Health and Human Services offices yesterday, and she had been denied temporary assistance benefits and food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And turns out that she was denied them, so she pulled out a gun and actually held one of the supervisors hostage. Eventually, that hostage was freed. But she ended up shooting herself and shooting both her children when she barricaded herself in the Health and Human Services office here down in Texas. And from my understanding is one of the kids is now dead. She's dead, except for one of the daughters in critical condition. And it's just mine. I wonder what desperation leads someone to do this. I understand this is a crime, and I don't think there's a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
But just how bad has the situation gotten in this country? Because, I mean, there's two really bad things going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what you thought.
Well, I don't know. I had not heard that story, Cash. It's not surprising. During the 80s, when the last time the Republicans tried to upend the economy and succeeded during the savings and loan ripoff, there were people who committed suicide, older people, because everything they had just been wiped out. We all know the stories from the 30s during the Great Depression, where people would take their own lives and in some instances kill their children before they took their own lives. So I don't understand that kind of desperation. I do understand desperation, but not to that degree. And I think that was what the email I just read, I don't know if you heard it, John in North Carolina, who said that, you know, until people really start to feel the hurt, not too much is going to happen to change the country. And even in the middle of that, and I agree with him, but in the middle of that, you also have people who get pushed completely over the edge. Now, again, I you know, we don't know. I mean, maybe you do because you live in Texas, but I don't have any idea the extenuating circumstances around this woman's life. If it was just sheer desperation from having been told no, no, over and over and over again, and the absolute panic that sets in and overtakes whatever ability to reason is left. You know, I don't know. It is a tragic story. I mean, no matter how you look at it, it's tragic, especially when you consider the innocent people involved, the children, of course, who didn't ask for any of this. I doubt if the woman asked for any of this. The bureaucrats that kept turning her down, they probably have rules they have to follow that are written by the state of Texas or the federal government. Who knows? So when situation like situations like we're dealing with in this country now get to the point that they are, yeah, people start doing things like this. It's a tragedy, isn't it?
I think it's a horrible tragedy. It's equally tragic.
It is. It's a bad story. Cash, thanks. I'm glad you called. Sorry I had to call with that kind of news, but thanks for checking in. Yeah, you know, the quick thing is just to blame the woman. You know, how could she do that? But, you know, you and I don't know. We don't know. The only thing I have to go on, and I've mentioned this on the air before, my mother was real close to 90 when she died 6 years ago, and she used to tell me stories of the Great Depression that she and her four siblings and her parents lived through. Her parents, of course, being Italian immigrants. Her father barely spoke English. That was my grandfather. And her mother did speak English. But their five children, of which my mother was the oldest, they went through the Depression as a family. And my grandfather had a gasoline filling station, they used to call them. Filling station, a tire store, and auto kind of repair thing place. His own business. And he had invested heavily in the stock market prior to the crash in 29. He lost everything in that crash and then just started over again and did it all again. But during the Depression, they survived. And one of the ways they survived was they raised a lot of their own food. They had the business to fall back on, and it was a business that, even though people were very, very without, there wasn't a lot of cash flowing through the economy. People still needed gasoline. They still needed to have their tires patched. They still needed an oil change, and so on and so forth. But my mother told me these horror stories that swirled around them in this small town in Ohio, where she and her siblings were raised, stories of people desperate to the point, as weird as it sounds, I'm not saying this for shock value, I've said it on the air before, but where the point of eating the family pet, of butchering the family dog or cats in order to survive. And people, she told me of two instances she knew of people who committed suicide by, there's a river that flows through this town, the Blanchard River, people jumping off the bridge and killing themselves because they just couldn't deal with the horror that was the Great Depression back in the 30s. So I don't can't understand. It's just, you know, unless something like what Cash just talked about, unless something like that happens to you, how can you understand it? You can read about it. You can think about it. You can commiserate over the results, but you can't really feel or understand what drives a person to do that. It has to be, as far as I'm concerned, it has to be more than just that. To kill one's own children is, I don't know, that's beyond my ability to even comprehend. But to kill one's own children in an act of desperation because there's no assistance, I don't know. See, this is where I veer off the path, because to me that is criminal. But I'm coming at it from a different perspective. I'm not the woman standing there in sheer desperation who has no idea of what to do. But there are things to do. There are things to do. I remember one night when we worked in Chicago. You remember, Kathy? You were in school and I got the call from the guy who was going to commit suicide by jumping off the bridge. Remember that? And we talked to him and talked to him and talked to him on the air. And managed to guess where he was, notified the Chicago police, and we got there. My show ended, we got there just about the time the police got there. He had climbed, if you remember, he had climbed down off the bridge, and he was in a churchyard. Remember that? And this was a guy who was just desperate, just totally desperate. And I don't know. I you know, that's probably the only real philosophical question we all answer every day when we wake up, is whether or not we're going to end our life that day, consciously end it, or not. I don't imagine everybody thinks about that, but that is a decision that is made, right? Isn't it? Or is that too Sartre-ish? I don't know. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But it's just hell to live in a society that can produce that kind of desperation. We'll be right back. In Northern California, listening online. Hello, Carol.
Hi. No, I'm listening on Green 960 as long as it lasts.
Right.
Hey, I wanted to make three points. One is about I looked into an HD radio today because I don't know if I'd get lucky enough to win one of those podcasts. I know all the answers all the time, but you got to call in at the exact right moment.
I hear you.
So I'm going to get an HD and listen to you out of Sacramento, you said last night, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Second point is about Obama. He's just running. I used to enjoy his speeches, but now I can't listen to them. They make my skin crawl. I hear the hypocrisy. Every time a family is killed in Pakistan or a village, you know, with those drones. And every time I realize how close we are to cooking the planet, I just hear him as unctuous. He goes back on everything. He's just campaigning. That's all he's doing.
Well, and, you know, in realistic, real politic terms, I guess I would come to that same conclusion. But I still want to believe, you know, that idea, sure, that you want to believe. We have been without effective leadership in this country for so long. Yeah. And to have someone who presented himself the way Obama did during the campaign, yeah, before the election, you know, I've gotten into self-chastisement and said a lot of progressives did the same thing, believed something that he may not have been saying, but he got more votes, I think, than any president since Reagan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I see that as how slick he is. I think he's the perfect front man. It was the perfect time. And before you go off there, I want to talk about the desperation of that woman who killed herself and her children and one of her children. And I know you got a break coming up.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't experienced this personally, but I am a writer in San Francisco. I write about politics. I wrote about a man named Randall Dunklin recently who has been homeless in a wheelchair on the streets of San Francisco for years. Mild mental disability. Tried to go down to social services last spring, which they've defunded. You know, all of these services in San Francisco are being defunded. Went down to get some help, finally. He's on the street. He's trying to get some help. And you have no idea, well, maybe you do, of how demeaning the treatment is of people. This guy was so desperate, he went down there, wheeled in his wheelchair all the way down there, miles, downtown San Francisco, couldn't get any help, and just out of desperation took out a little pocket knife, started to try to slash tires around the area. The police came along, and four or five of them shot him in the back, and he went on trial for police brutality because they claimed that he cut him with his little pocket knife. I mean, this is the way people are treated, and this is kind of half of the story of that desperation that you feel.
Sure.
And you know, it's similar. But I talked to the guy and his friends, and I know that frustration. You know, from folks, what do you do? What is the future of your children going to be like? Mm-hmm. And when you're in emotional distress, you really start doing things like taking out a pocket knife and kind of stabbing at tires.
Right, right.
So I'm hoping maybe that gives a little bit of...
Well, I can understand frustration even beyond the level of slashing tires. But I can't, and maybe it's because I'm a parent, but I have grandchildren now. I have nieces and nephews. I can't get my mind around the idea of being, or maybe the word I'm looking for is empathy. I can't feel the empathy that would prompt a mother or a father to, out of desperation, kill their own child. I just can't do it. I am not capable of experiencing that. What I hit is a brick wall when I try to understand that kind of horror that mother must have gone through. I hit a brick wall, and beyond that brick wall is just me accusing her of killing her own child. You understand what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to is the total frustration,
right,
and not knowing what you're going to do. How are you going to raise these children?
Sure.
What's their future going to be like? And I'm not justifying at all. I'm trying to put myself where she is, and I've seen something similar to that level of just fear and frustration.
Well, I hear you, Carol. Loud and clear. I'm glad you called, all right?
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care.
You too.
All right.
Bye.
Appreciate you checking in. I can remember early in, when I started in radio back in the early 80s and then into the mid 80s when we were in a, you know, serious recessionary period. It was local radio. It wasn't syndicated. It wasn't national. It was local radio in Atlanta. And story after story like these. And I'm afraid they're going to increase. We'll be back after the break. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. News that has come out, depending on your point of view, this week, this month, this year, since the Industrial Revolution began, or in the history of the human race. Take your pick there. You've got a menu of how important the story was that we mentioned last night about global warming the emissions that cause global warming rose more last year than ever. The largest absolute jump in any year since the Industrial Revolution, and the largest percentage increase probably ever. And what we talked about last night, the combustion of coal represented more than half of the growth in emissions. In the U.S., emissions dropped during the recession year of 2009, but rose again last year. The United States is now the world's second largest emitter of greenhouse gases, pumping 1.5 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere last year. China injected 2.2 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. Now, the idea that we have gone beyond the tipping point, you know, there's always a tipping point, right? Tipping point, tipping point, tipping point. The point of no return, it's sometimes referred to in early aviation history, or maybe it was the pilots during World War II or whenever, when aviation became a major tool of warfare. There was a point on your journey to bomb some hapless city where you reached the point of no return, where there wasn't enough fuel to turn around and come back. The idea being that you would bomb the hell out of the city and then bail out. So we've kind of reached that point of no return where we've all but lost the battle to reduce the damage from global warming. And in the meantime, I read something over the weekend. Was it the last weekend or maybe the weekend before? About the government of Brazil that has decided to continue to slash and burn into the Amazon, destroying square kilometer after square kilometer of rainforest, the very lungs of the planet. And one of the reasons they're doing it is to satisfy the insatiable demand for beef, a cancer-producing agent, according to nutritionists. If you're with the Beef Council, kiss my ass. Don't be sending me emails or writing to my advertisers. You know, I couldn't care less. But this land is being cleared and destroyed. Indigenous people driven to extinction. Lakes, streams being polluted beyond. It just doesn't stop. It's not just the United States, I guess, is my point. And as Bill McKibben pointed out, I shared this with you. He wrote something at Common Dreams on Monday. He said that what this means in diplomatic terms is that the endless talks underway in Durban, South Africa should be more important than ever. They should be the focus of a planetary population desperate to figure out how it's going to survive this century. And like I say, this will not be an issue for me. I'll be dead and gone long before the century gets really going. So a lot of people listening to this program. But we have nieces and nephews and kids and grandkids. And what about them? But as I mentioned last night, the Republican Party has decided that global warming is a hoax, thanks to Rush Limbaugh and the rest of the pigs, the filthy, slimy pigs like Limbaugh, who have set the tone, produce the memes that corporate America gave them. This is a reason why radio programs like mine and other liberals, I mean real liberals, are being slammed into some 3 a.m. ghetto or dropped altogether. Because corporate America does not want this information out. Period. And they will do anything. And it's very simple. You take someone on the air who's talking about this and eliminate the program. Or, in order to keep up a facade that you're still maintaining some kind of balance, you shuffle that program to 3 a.m. in the morning. Who in the hell listens at 3 a.m. in the morning, right? Or you shuffle it onto some high-definition radio channel that nobody has. This is the obscenity. This is the obscenity. And as Bill McKibben pointed out last night, for you right-wing freak heads who think Occupy Wall Street is a radical movement because you listen to the swine that that dominate talk radio and now are going to dominate even more in markets that have been traditionally liberal. They will tell you that the Occupy movement is radical. What they don't tell you is that the CEO of Exxon and all these energy companies that get up every morning and go to work changing the chemical composition of the atmosphere, that is radical. That is killing you. That is destroying you. What would you do, truth seeker, if someone walked into your child's elementary school with a loaded AK-47 and threatened to start killing your children? What would you do? That is exactly what the oil company and the coal company executives do every single goddamn day of your child's life. Every single day. And who wants you to know about that? Well, not corporate radio, not corporate America. Oh, hell no. You know, you want to hear something like that? Listen to some local 100-watt, you know, little listener-supported station someplace down in the neighborhood where nobody can hear it. That's where you hear stuff like that, you know. It's just sometimes almost more than I can handle to realize that this dominance of right-wing radio has had a specific goal. And that specific goal was to make sure that no point of view other than the corporatist point of view is even heard on the airwaves, on the radio, by Americans. Period. There's no debate about this. None whatsoever. You know, the lie that right-wing radio puts out there and all their zombies who run it is that, well, you know, nobody will support liberal talk. That's a complete lie. It's a total lie. It's an absolute lie. If you have two stations in the same market, and one is a right-wing 50,000 watt boomer that covers, you know, like two states, and it's all right-wing, and you have another station that's a 500-watt little station that covers, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 miles in any direction from the transmitter, and you've got advertising dollars to spend, where are you going to put the advertising dollars? 3, 2, 1. Exactly. This is how it's designed. This is how it's done. This is how dissenting opinion, this is how using the airwaves for public discourse is utterly and absolutely and has been for the past 30 years smashed.
Oh,
had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Email here from Cliff in Portland, Oregon, and a KPOJ listener. He writes, Mike, as I listened tonight to your discussion, this is last night, about the back page news concerning CO2 in the year 2009, I wondered if part of the spike was the tundra fire in the Arctic I had heard about. But after checking via Google, I found that was in the summer of 2007. The ability, Cliff writes, of our so-called representatives in Congress to ignore the science, belittle the scientists, and sadly, abandon the good of the planet for short-term profit, manipulation, greed, never ceases to amaze me. Bill McKibben, Al Gore, tens of thousands of great but unknown scientists, overpowered by the messaging that obscene wealth can purchase, preying on a dumber and more confused general society. So back to the topic, CO2 continuing to rise. For the first time in recorded history and ancient history, the temperature and CO2 indexes are crossing over. Unlike every other warm spell we have had, unlike every other warm spell we have been able to measure in the ice cores going back hundreds of thousands of years. That puts the theory of it's just a natural cycle, you know, the right-wing theory, out the window. The tundra fire in the Arctic in 2007 was also underreported. The first major one in 11,000 years burned because the tundra was too dry. Burned 400 square miles and released in 2 months the entire amount of CO2 that the entire Arctic tundra absorbs in 1 year. So as the Earth gets warmer, the ice caps melt, the tundra dries out, and we will expect to see more of these fires, many more. We, the people, start the CO2 buildup, but in time, other things like tundra fires pop up and accelerate the process, unintended consequences. As a logical person, engineer, scientist, I am at my wit's end to comprehend how the science could be so blatantly ignored. We're at a meteorite on a collision course with Earth. I'm sure we could muster the funds and powers, listen to the scientists, mount an offensive, blow the meteor off its course. And sadly, even a larger meteor would probably do less damage than the CO2 may in the lifetime of our children. Carry on, Mike. I find myself drawn to your show, commentary, share your anger and frustration, admire your ability to clarify topics, force us to think and consider. Cliff. Well, that last sentence was very nice. Thank you, Cliff. I am just a reporter. Trust me on that. But thanks, Cliff. It just, I'm at a point where I just don't know how to deal with the attitude of the political class in this country that is now a wholly owned subsidiary of companies like Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's company that now owns hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of radio stations, and a determination has been made to shut down any voice other than the corporate voice in order to satisfy, apparently, Mitt Romney's lust to be president and the whole corporate structure in this country to eliminate voices that, you know, what's the expression, wander off the reservation? That's a good expression, isn't it? But the frustration level that I feel sometimes is just, it's incredible. And then, I get the typical emails from dumbasses on the right who focus on the kind of coarse language that I use. And it is coarse. I don't know how to make it uncoarse. We're talking about life and death. We're talking about your life, your death, my life, my death. We're talking about planetary life and death. And I, or anyone, is supposed to sit down and say, well, gosh darn, I really, or, you know, engage on some faux intellectual level. This is gut-wrenching stuff. This is the kind of stuff like when your country is invaded. What do? Do you lock and load and say, oh golly, please, Mr. Enemy, stand still so I might shoot you in the head? Or do you say, you rancid son of a bitch, and you open fire? What do you normally do? Oh, why am I asking Republicans? You people are no more interested in defending your country, your home, your neighborhood, or your planet than you are interested in peeing up a rope. And everybody knows that with your fake patriotism and your fake, oh, look at Newt Gingrich. He's your boy. He's really your boy. Remember the little ad he cut with Nancy Pelosi about global climate change? Remember that? And now he says, oh, biggest mistake I ever made. Isn't that just so typical of Republicans? Filthy. Filthy, unconscionable, hypocritical, death-dealing Republicans. So, to the right-wingers who, I don't know, it's, I guess, gives you sexual release or something to send me your tacky little emails and continue. You know, it doesn't make any difference. You will choke to death, too. Your children will die also. Your grandchildren will cease to be able to breathe also. So go ahead, continue your dumbass emails to me. In the meantime, though, wouldn't you be better served to get off your lardy Republican asses and try to save your home, your planet? Oh, never mind. This last night too, I just feel like I didn't give enough coverage to this, and I don't see this stuff on network news or cable news or the long form shows that you see on MSNBC. You're never going to hear this on Fox because the function of Fox and the Rupert Murdoch terror broadcast operation is to destroy this country. Rupert Murdoch is an invader, and he has decided. He was an invader when he went to the UK. He's an invader here. Actually, he was an invader when he was born in Australia. Son of a bitch is from some other dimension. But his sole purpose is to destroy everything. He's a dying old man. And he likes the idea of death to other things around him. It's sick. It's disgusting. So you don't hear any of this on the Rupert Murdoch Terror Network. The other corporate-owned networks, you don't hear anything either because so many of them have deep ties into corporate America, and they're not going to cut their own throats. They depend on all that advertising, all those millions of dollars, right? But the story from last night, Japan's crippled nuclear power plant has leaked about. This is what TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, is admitting to. Leaked about 45 tons of highly radioactive water over the weekend into the ocean. And according to the article I have here, a pool of radioactive water was discovered Sunday around a decontamination device, TEPCO said in a statement on its website. After the equipment was turned off, the leak appeared to stop. Later, workers found a crack in the concrete barrier leaking the contaminated water into a gutter that leads to the ocean. The pooled water around the purification device contains cesium-134, cesium-137, the 137 is dangerous because it can last for decades in the environment, releasing cancer-causing radiation. The half-life of cesium-134 is about 2 years. The half-life of cesium-137 is about 30 years. So you do the math. And as Bruce Enberg pointed out last night, if these meltdowns, these China syndrome events are occurring, and there's no reason to believe they are not in these five different reactors, at least one or two or three or four, we'll never know how many. Once there is contact between groundwater and these cores, then you will have an explosion. It will be a thermal explosion, but the result is pretty much the same. It will spread nuclear radiation over an enormous area, rendering that area essentially uninhabitable. Probably for, I don't know, 1,000 years, 5,000, 10,000, not that that matters, but just, you know. The other, big story that I can't seem to understand why Anderson Cooper or Brian Williams or Rachel Maddow or even the thugs like O'Reilly and Neil Cavuto and, you know, this handful of household names that mainstream America to greater or lesser degrees rely on for news, why they're not talking about this National Defense Authorization Act. That there seems to be either an ignorance or a specific unwillingness to cover this. I'm not saying that some of these names I just mentioned haven't given it a little bit of attention, but there is more attention focused on Herman Cain's marital problems or Newt Gingrich's psychosis or the idiocy of human waste like Bachman and Perry and the rest of these clowns. Meanwhile, our Congress is slowly but surely adding a piece of radical legislation. There's that word again, radicalize, like the head of GE or the head of ExxonMobil. This is radicalism, not Occupy Wall Street, not people getting together in a park in L.A. or Oakland or San Diego or Atlanta. That's not radical. That's survival. This is radical. A piece of legislation that defines the United States as a battlefield. And with that definition, makes U.S. citizens subject to military arrest and detainment for life without access to a trial or an attorney. And who is talking about this? I mean, I don't know. That's not a challenge. It's an honest question. Is the lineup of liberals over on MSNBC saying anything about this? Are the few remaining, the handful, the five or six still left on the air talking about this? How about the handful of liberals that persist in not dying and continue to webstream? Are they talking about it? I honestly don't know. But as David Seaman, writing at Credit Card Outlaw, puts it, guys, this is far more important than Penn State's disgusting creep of the decade. Or even Dr. Conrad Murray's sentencing. Yeah, I would think so. Wouldn't you? So what do you want to call it? David says, call it a military junta, a secret invalidation of American civil rights, a Congress gone mad. Whatever it is, it needs to be covered by the press and quickly. And David writes, I emailed producers and on-air talent at the three major cable news networks last weekend. Not one of them was willing to step up to the plate and report on this appalling legislation, which would give Americans roughly the same protections as citizens in China or Saudi Arabia. But bloggers and the ACLU's analysis have made it easy for anybody who wants to take a look at this, anybody in broadcast, whether it's television or radio. The bill, first of all, violates the Posse Comitatus Act because it will allow federal military personnel to engage in domestic law enforcement. This is profoundly unconstitutional. You know, you have some half-witted, I don't know, insect like Michelle Bachmann crawling around talking about Barack Obama's health care law being unconstitutional. For Christ's sake! This is unconstitutional! The National Defense Authorization Act! And you can read Lindsey Graham's defense of this bill. His defense tries to make the United States a battlefield. David writes, has anyone told these guys that Osama bin Laden and his deputies are dead? Those still alive are running from drone strikes on a daily basis. So who exactly are we fighting against? Are you protecting us from a handful of almost entirely peaceful college kids at the Occupy protests? If so, martial law and throwing out 200 years of basic civil rights seems a tad excessive, wouldn't you say? Huh? Finally, as the ACLU points out, you won't have any trouble booking an expert or a talking head who will tell you how dangerous and counterproductive this act is. And David, you know, makes a plea, you know, please do your jobs. This is the kind of story that wins journalism awards and makes careers. And then he has an update. To the mainstream media's credit, Keith Olbermann of Current TV has now mentioned the National Defense Authorization Act's harmful provision. And I've been told that Dylan Radigan of MSNBC is drawing attention to it as well. Nobody talks about that, and nobody talks about the report on the increase in carbon into the atmosphere that puts us almost, unless something is done immediately, beyond the scope of redeeming the planet and everything, well, not everything, but all human life on it. But no, we'll spend hours, I have on this program, talking about these filthy cretins like Herman Cain or Newt Gingrich. That certainly advances the idea of human civilization, talking about that, doesn't it? I don't know, man. I don't know. I can just see some more of these cretinous right-wingers warming up their computer. I'm going to write to Mike Vallari and tell him all he does is use harsh language. And he says, son of a bitch, and he takes the Lord's name in vain. And all you do is bitch and complain. You don't have any solutions. Except that it involves the day-to-day survival of people. The Senate Democrats yesterday said they would try for the fifth time in 2 months to raise taxes on top earners to pay for legislation that would reduce the Social Security payroll taxes and avoid a tax increase for tens of millions of American workers. See, when it involves 360,000 millionaires and billionaires, the Republicans will eat their own vomit in order to stop any kind of a tax increase going to those people. But when it comes to 130 million working class Americans, the Republicans just raise their legs and urinate all over all of us. So the payroll tax cut is due to run out. And when it runs out, it'll be effectively a tax increase of up to $1,000 a year for working class Americans. Obama is trying to stop this in the only way that he's decided would work. Of course, my way would be to pull down the entire system and start over again, but that's a whole different program. So Obama is trying to do it his way, which is to extend the tax cut. And since everybody is out of their minds and totally insane, up to and including Obama, about deficit reduction or debt reduction, then, oh my goodness, we have to pay for this somehow. Yes, indeedy, we do. So let's put a 3.5% surtax on people who earn over $2 million a year. Republicans say no. Because the poor millionaires and billionaires, oh, the poor little babies, they're the ones that buy the Congress. So why should members of Congress, especially Republicans, support the idea of taxing their benefactors? They won't do it. Well, two senators now are offering a bipartisan compromise that could help break the back of this Republican crap. The proposal is put together by Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, and Clara McCaskill, Democrat of Missouri, both of whom, by the way, have voted in favor of the National Defense Authorization Act, you know, to bring a police state here. But that's, you know, we covered that last segment. So let's move on, right? Okay. Clara McCaskill and Susan Collins would extend the current payroll tax cut for employees and reduce the employer's share of the payroll tax as well. It would also provide additional money for highways, bridges, and other job-creating transportation projects, right? All that is in there. Now, these two senators have come up with the idea of offsetting the cost with the 2% surtax. That's what the general idea that Obama put out there on incomes in excess of $1 million a year, but would carve out protection for small business owners who report business income on their personal tax returns. Now, this is what these filthy, disgusting Republicans have been using as their excuse. Well, we're not going to vote for a tax increase on small businesses. Okay. So here's a way to protect these small businesses that Republican senators insist they're trying to protect. Only very quickly, we will see how ridiculous their argument is, because they're not going to go for this. This would get the bill passed and, oh my God, might make Obama look like a better candidate to return to office than one of these vomiting Republicans. So the Republicans in the Senate are not going to pass this either. They're not. Susan Collins, the only Republican across the aisle, so to speak, and voted to take up the Democrats' payroll tax bill last week. Susan Collins said, quote, "One of the primary objections to a surtax on very wealthy people has been its impact on small business. That concern resonated with me. The fact that we have been able, in a bipartisan way now, to come up with the means of protecting small businesses is potentially a breakthrough." By bipartisan, she means she and Claire McCaskill. As Obama pointed out the other day, when the Republicans took over the House at the beginning of the year, they explicitly changed the rules to say that tax cuts don't have to be paid for. Tax cuts. Spending has to be paid for, but tax cuts don't. So Obama says, forgive me a little confusion here when I hear them insisting on tax cuts being paid for. Well, come on, Barack. Come on, you're a very smart man. You understand this. They don't give a goddamn about paying for tax cuts. They don't care about the working class. They don't care about the middle class. They're trying to gut you. And you know this, but you have to stand out there and pretend like you don't know it. Like a liberal talk show host are supposed to pretend like they don't understand what's going on with the corporate radio owners like Bain Investments LLC, or Bain, whatever the hell it is, Mitt Romney's program, or Mitt Romney's investment company, that has determined that liberal talk radio in this country will goddamn die. This happens at the beginning of every presidential election cycle. Every single one. I've seen it happen so many times. And by snuffing off those voices, well, what have you done? You have reduced the, confusion that voters might feel. The confusion that arises when you get two diametrically opposed points of view, one of which will destroy the country. That would be the Republican point of view. And one of which will not quite destroy it, at least not yet. That would be the Democratic point of view. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Some stories.